All right, so as we continue now, we're looking at the different strategies for restoring certainty, the first of which, the Hegelian strategy, is to revive reason in a refurbished, more sophisticated form. The second approach is to restrict reason to its proper functions, the approach of the scientist or the positivist of the 19th century. I want you to notice that these two strategies have something very important in common, and that is that they both, for all of their differences, they both deny the noumena. They both deny the noumena. If you look back on the board here, with Kant, we have things in themselves, metaphysical reality, and Kant was agnostic about this. He said, all you can know is the phenomena, and the active mind of man makes the phenomena intelligible, makes it rational. Hegel denies this noumenal phenomenal distinction. There is no longer things in themselves. For Hegel, there's only the phenomena. However, Hegel believes that the phenomena have got to be understood idealistically in terms of the dialectical development of man's reasoning. And so Hegel takes an idealistic reasoning approach and says that when we study the phenomena, we will eventually get metaphysical reality. We'll get the absolute if we reason properly. But he doesn't want to say that there's a difference between things in themselves and things as they appear. He doesn't want to grant that. He wants to say we can get past Kant's agnosticism by reasoning properly regarding phenomena. The positivists, on the other hand, they deny that there's a noumenal realm because all they're interested in is materialistic phenomena. So they deny this upper story of noumena as well, but not in the way of Hegel, who's an idealist, but in the way of Buchner and others who are materialists. We don't have to worry about Kant's agnosticism about things in themselves because there is no things in themselves and we don't care about them. All we do is we study the phenomena of our experience, the way things are observed, and that's the only reality that there is. So that's kind of interesting, the way there's identity and difference, eh? These two approaches, reviving reason, the Hegelian approach, is idealistic. Those who want to restrict reason are not scientific, but scientism, this following of the positivistic approach that says there isn't any idea or realm that has to be known in that way. So they both deny Kant's noumena in order to get beyond the agnosticism of Kant, but they're approaching it completely differently. Now, if anybody has any questions about this, make sure you ask me now. I want you to understand how the noumena is denied by both Hegel and by the positivists, and yet they don't agree philosophically at all. Their approach is really at odds with one another. And then let me show you another interesting connection between these three strategies for restoring certainty. The positivists, who want to restrict reason to the material world, if you will, and then the romanticists and others who want to disregard reason in favor of alternative access to metaphysical reality, they both restrict reasoning to the phenomena. They both restrict reason to the phenomena. Now, I've just explained that to you in my previous observations. The positivists say there is no noumena, so reason can only apply to our observations, to the phenomenal world. These other philosophies, romanticism, voluntarism, subjectivism, existentialism,
These other philosophies that prefer an alternative access to metaphysical reality, they agree that there is a metaphysical reality beyond our observations, beyond the material world, but they say reason's no good for finding it. And so they can agree with the positivists that man's reasoning should be limited to scientific study and research. But they say there's something more to man than reasoning. In fact, something more important, and that's man's volition, man's feeling, man's intuition. And those approaches can put us in touch with ultimate reality. The reason we try to diagram things in this way is so you'll see the connection between various thinkers. There are ways in which positions 1 and 2 can agree against number 3, and there are ways in which positions 2 and 3 can agree against number 1, and ways in which 1, 2, and 3 all disagree with Kant. And so I think by putting it up here and diagramming it this way, we can keep track of the relationships and better understand what's going on in the development of 19th century philosophy. Hopefully we can get back to philosophical certainty if we can revive reason, Hegel said, if we can restrict reason, the positivist said, or if we can finally disregard reason and get to the proper access to ultimate reality according to the Romantics, the Romanticists, the Voluntarists, the Existentialists, and so forth. If you're with me so far, I'm going to try one more time to show you a couple of connections here, and then we'll finally talk about Hegel. Notice that positions 1 and 3, the revival of reason in a new form, and the disregarding of reason in favor of an alternative access, both see the incompetence of the old Enlightenment form of reasoning, what might be called the old logic. They agree with each other, for all of their disagreements, that the Enlightenment's naive approach to reason or logic is inadequate, incompetent. And of course, then they diverge as to how to deal with that. Hegel says we need a new dialectical form of logic, a more sophisticated, refurbished form of logic, whereas the alternative access people say, no, we don't need a new logic, we need now to go to an intuitional approach or a volitional approach to reality, get away from reason altogether. So do you save reason but refurbish it, or do you dump it in favor of a different dance partner? That's what we're talking about here. 1 and 3 agree with each other that the old reason won't work. By the way, 1 and 3 also agree with each other, and please make sure you get this in your notes, in that they affirm that reality is continuous rather than discrete. Over against the Enlightenment approach to the nature of reality, Hegel, who wanted to revive reason, and the Romanticist and Voluntarist and Existentialist, who disregard reason, they both will agree that there's more of a flow and a dynamism, a unity in all things that are real. As we need to understand that we don't have one truth over here and another truth here. There's a sense in which these two truths are connected to each other. And so you have your thesis, you have your antithesis, but yet there's a synthesis between them. All things are connected. And everything in the world is connected. And thought and reality are connected in some ways, according to Hegel. Well, those who took the alternative access route, interestingly, they too wanted to emphasize the unity of being. And so in Schopenhauer, you're going to get to what is basically a kind of pantheism, a Hindu view that you are everything that you experience, that all is one. Okay? So in the 19th century, We are shifting away from the old naive approach to reason. Some people are just saying, away with it, an ouse, get out, okay? Shifting away from it, or we want to refurbish it and have a new dialectical approach to reasoning. And secondly, we're moving away from the view of reality where there are individual things out there that are related to one another externally to a more internal, continuous, and unified view of reality where everything is part of everything else. Okay, with these words of explanation and some idea of where Hegel falls in the development of philosophy, we can now turn our attention specifically to George Wilhelm Hegel, G.W.F. Hegel, who was born in 1770 in Stuttgart, born in a poor family, but nevertheless was able to secure a university education. He studied theology at the University of Tübingen. Before I go any further on Hegel, I didn't comment earlier, but it's good to get it down here. Hopefully in my lectures on the history of philosophy, you have the advantage of all of my reading and past experience and the courses I've had and, of course, my own Christian reflection and so forth. But nevertheless, I do want to acknowledge that the organizing core for my research when I teach the history of philosophy is W.T. Jones, who now has a 5-volume series on the history of philosophy out, and I do want to give credit where credit is due. I depart from him often enough and supplement wildly, and there's much more there than what you might find, but nevertheless, that does give something of the structure and development of much of these lectures, and so that footnote for bibliographical purposes. Back to Hegel. Why are we studying Hegel if he was born in 1770? I thought this was a course on the 1800s, or excuse me, on the 1900s. The 1800s and the 1900s together. I get it right. 19th and 20th century philosophy. Well, Kant's philosophy and his life take us up to the edge of the 19th century. He dies in 1804. And what we're doing is we're studying post-Kantian developments, which include Hegel and others, even though they may have been born in the 18th century. The great influence of Hegel and these others is seen in the 19th century, just so you understand that. And on your paper assignment where I say you're supposed to write on someone who died before 1930, that too is recognizing these are artificial distinctions. But the people who were most influential in the 19th century or the 1800s will all have died by 1930. Some were born before the 1800s. Okay, so 1770, Hegel. Hegel worked, I told you that he got a theology education at Tübingen. That should be of interest to us as Christians, that's what he was initially attracted to. And in his youth, he apparently wrote several essays on Christianity, but later in his life, he kind of, not so much that he dumped them, he didn't destroy them, he kept them, but he didn't publish them. He considered it, I guess, rather naive and elementary in terms of his later thought and development. Hegel worked as a private tutor for a number of years, as a newspaper editor, and even as a school principal. And it wasn't until 1816 that he was appointed to a professorship at the University of Heidelberg. But a year later, his reputation was such that within a year, he was appointed to succeed J.G. Fichte in philosophy at the University of Berlin. In 1818, he took up teaching philosophy at the University of Berlin. Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, who should appear on your timeline, was an idealist who followed Kant and put a great emphasis upon the ego, the I, who is the subject of knowledge. I just thought you'd appreciate that in light of our discussion a little while ago, how Kant shifted things. Fichte picked up on that and maximized it. The center of philosophy and the development of the world is from the perspective of the ego. Nevertheless, when Fichte stepped down or died, Hegel began teaching at Berlin in 1818. As Hegel aged, he came more and more to favor order over against freedom, unity over against diversity. His great thirst was for a universal, rational system that was logical and was adequate to reality. Because later in his life, the Kingdom of Prussia gave state approval to his philosophy, you might not be surprised that Hegel considered this nation the apex of human history. I mean, any country that's smart enough to approve of Hegel's own philosophy has got to be a pretty good country, right? Toward the end of his life, something of a Hegelian cult developed. He had quite a following. Not really groupies, as we would speak of today, but intellectual groupies, I guess. And the Hegelians divided into the left-hand and right-hand Hegelians. We'll talk about that when we get to the development of his social and political philosophy. Hegel died in the cholera epidemic in Berlin in the year 1831. There's no question that Hegel's theories are difficult to understand, and that difficulty is responded to in various ways. Some people say the difficulty is Hegel's fault. He was just confused. He was just too puffed up and overblown in what he was trying to say. Others would say his theories are difficult to understand because he was just so much smarter than we are. And yet others would say his theories are difficult to understand because the theories are so much more adequate to reality, which is deeper and more complicated than we had ever thought. It is certainly true that the language of Hegel is obfuscating in its character. If you're having a hard time sleeping, my advice, open Hegel, read for 3 minutes, you're a goner. You cannot read this fellow when you're sleepy. If you're drowsy, you're not going to be able to handle this stuff. Even when you're wide awake, it may make you drowsy. Very hard. The vocabulary, I already had told you my introductory remarks to this course, philosophy can be abstract. Well, Hegel's philosophy takes abstraction to the limit. He's so abstract and vague, is he, that sadly there is no universal agreement as to the nature of his views. You have different interpretations of Hegel, different emphases and so forth. You'll even get an argument between people as to what his greatest works are. You know, where do you find the core Hegel? Is it in the phenomenology of mind? Is that it? Or is it his encyclopedia of philosophical sciences? Or is it the logic? Okay, and he has other things too. Well, I'm not going to take a position there, but I do want you to know the bibliography. His book, The Phenomenology of Mind, sometimes called The Phenomenology of the Spirit, was published in 1807. It ran to over 750 pages. And this is the daunting thing about it. Hegel considered it only a preface to the great system of philosophy he proposed to develop. Y'all hear me? 750 plus pages. And he said, that's just the preface. That's just to kind of lay out the program, if you will, for what needs to be done. He gives an outline of that system that is to be developed in the Encyclopedia of the Philosophical Sciences, sometimes translated the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which was published 10 years later in 1817 and was subsequently revised a number of times. So Hegel has a preface to his system, the Phenomenology of Mind. He has an outline of the system to be developed, the Encyclopedia of Philosophy. But the only part of this grand metaphysical system that he wanted to develop, the only part that he finished, was the logic. And it came out in two versions between the years 1812 and 1816. After Hegel's death, his students published notes from his lectures, particularly on the philosophy of history, the history of philosophy, and the philosophy of art. Yes, I did say that both ways. He lectured on the history of philosophy, but also on the philosophy of history. And the history of philosophy and philosophy of history were complemented by the philosophy of art. But these were published after he died. Okay, that's just to give you an introduction to the life of Hegel and to his writings and something about his stature and the way people have responded to him. Let's see if we can understand his system of thought. I've already told you, I hope I haven't intimidated you, I've already told you it can be very difficult, the vocabulary is tough, but that does not mean this lecture will be difficult. Because maybe I've gotten it wrong, I hope not, I want to be accurate, but I think I can explain to you in language that's fairly understandable what Hegel was getting at. And so, listen to me, you're not having to read Hegel, so don't be intimidated, don't tune out right now. To understand Hegel, I think it's best to begin with this observation. The starting point for Hegel is the universe is rational. The universe is rational. Or in the place of the universe, we can say reality. Reality is rational. The universe is rational. And in particular, whatever is rational is the universe. And so this is the is of identity. I'll put an equal mark there. So he's not just saying the universe is characterized by rationality. Do you all know the difference between the is of identity and the is of predication that from your previous education? If I say my dog is brown, I'm not identifying my dog with brownness. I'm predicating brown of my dog. Okay? But if I say Robert Bonson is my father, I'm not just predicating fatherliness of Robert Bonson. I'm identifying my father with him. So is can be used in both ways. For Hegel, to say the universe is rational is to use the is of identity. The rational is the universe, too, or reality. The real is the rational. The real is the rational. Hegel was an idealist. I'm still explaining to you the real is the rational. Hegel was an idealist. According to him, reality is absolute mind or reason. Or spirit. Reality is absolute mind, and it manifests itself both in the history of nature and in human history, social, political history. Reality is spirit, it's mind, and that mind or spirit manifests itself in the history, the development of the natural world, and in the development of human history. This mind is universal and cannot therefore be identified with the mind of any particular person. When Hegel refers to mind, he's not referring to my mind or your mind or his mind. He's talking about the grand universal mind. Every particular mind is only an aspect of that universal mind. Now, the universal mind displays itself broadly, corporately, generally, as the German word puts it, as Weltgeist. How many of you know German? Good. So Weltgeist, world spirit. The universal mind manifests itself as Weltgeist, and this Weltgeist is seen in every particular mind. So that your subjective consciousness, your thinking, your mind, your subjective consciousness and all of your reasoning, all of your rational activity is a phase of, if you will, as Hegel put it, a moment of, a phase of the development of the absolute mind. So the absolute mind is working its way out in moments or phases in the reasoning and rationality of your particular subjective mind. And so that dictum, the real is the rational, can be understood to express the identity of reality and the rational process that we're all engaged in. If you would understand the nature of thought, you would understand the nature of reality as a whole. And that's why Hegel put such emphasis on the science of logic. Because if we understand reasoning, we're understanding reality as a whole. And even the natural world, according to Hegel, manifests the reasoning of absolute mind. Now that reasoning is dialectical. We're going to come back to that in a little while. The kind of reasoning that absolute mind engages in is a dialectical reasoning, but nature shows that dialectical activity of mind. And Hegel believed you could study nature, therefore, from a rational perspective, which would be superior to a merely empirical study of nature. You can see how politically incorrect this guy is today. Hegel said, the philosophers are in a better position to tell you about nature than the scientist, because nature works its way out as part of the universal mind reasoning. And so there is a philosophical, necessary and logical explanation for everything that we know in the natural world. Let me quote Hegel for you. Spirit is alone reality. It is the inner being of the world, that which essentially is. It is in its existence aware of itself as an object in which its own self is reflected. Mind, when which thus developed, knows itself to be mind, is science. Aren't you glad you're listening to a lecture rather than reading this stuff? And by the way, this is not just a joke. I cut out the tough part of the quotation. I have here all kinds of ellipses in here just so I can boil this down and try to make this understandable to you. Spirit is alone reality. That you've got, right? Reality is all of the spiritual nature. It's mind or ideal. It is the inner being of the world, that which essentially is. Ultimate reality, what essentially exists, the inner being of the world is spirit or mind. And then he goes on, it is in its existence aware of itself as an object in which its own self is reflected. You really can understand this. It just takes a little bit of thinking.